group.
Hour two of your Wednesday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. From Americans for Prosperity, a very tall man, Jason Flores, has joined us in studio. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
We before we dive into some legislative session news and a bit of a preview, we do need to wrap up Sam's top five for a Wednesday.
Number five.
Yeah, sorry, Jason Flores. We got to talk about Baby Yoda toys. From people.
Priorities, man.
According to a recent report on The Verge, Disney has begun issuing takedown notices for items related to the Mandalorian's breakout character, since the company has trademark jurisdiction over terms like Star Wars, The Mandalorian, Baby Yoda, and Yoda. Many independent vendors who used these keywords have had their listings deleted following complaints from Disney for using their intellectual property.
Not a big surprise. And, you know, this happens with popular, you know, things that kind of burst onto the scene and reach, you know, unexpected heights of popularity very quickly. The Etsy vendors all roll out stuff and they capitalize on it for a little while until the companies come in and be like, wait, slow down.
John, I ordered your Christmas gift off of Etsy, mm-hmm. and it has Baby Yoda on it. I don't think it's available on Etsy anymore.
What are you talking about? Unexpected popularity? You put Baby Yoda or a relative of you? I don't know. Is that decided yet? Have we figured it out? We can spend my whole time on Star Wars.
He's not Baby Yoda.
To the Star Wars.
It's the timeline. He is a Yoda species, but we don't know what the Yoda species is because we've never been told.
But the point is still unexpected.
I think it was
cute little baby.
Well, there's actually rumors that he was not going to make it through the series, and that ended up changing. Actually,
oh my gosh, can you imagine? Kill him off?
Yeah. Well, because I mean, you don't know in situations like that. I mean, even if you're creating it. I mean, if you got a group of people around, and this is actually the wise thing to do. If you got a people around and you're creating, but I don't care what the content is, you're creating the content and you're making an assumption something's going to go viral, 9 times out of 10, you're going to be wrong.
True.
You know what I mean? So I don't think that they probably all thought, wow, this is going to be really awesome. But you don't know until you get it out there. And it's a bummer for, like, I get it for Disney. I think ultimately it's not going to hurt, you know, I mean, Disney's going to end up owning everything at some point in time. So I don't see a big deal about when people go and try to, you know, when they make things like this, but I understand Disney's position because you've got to draw a line somewhere, mm-hmm. you know, and so if they don't draw the line here and they mm-hmm. say, well, let people go and, you know, help spread the joy of Baby Yoda, it's like, no, somebody else will come in and take advantage of it and use that as a precedent. Sure.
Yeah, no, and I do think it was, as John said, I think it was somewhat unexpected. You know, I don't think they expected it to turn into the pop culture phenomenon that it did.
Yeah, I totally agree.
It became so huge so quickly.
I just assumed that Disney marketed everything and created a stuffed animal for everything.
Right.
And then when they don't sell, it's just, okay. Yeah. Part of the plan.
Yeah, now they're pillows in a third world country.
Sure.
Well, that's the sort of the problem that that they're in right now when it comes to even making toys anymore, because you just don't know what's going to hit. And so what ends up happening is these big companies now, I don't care what franchise or, you know, IP it is, they all wait before they start mass producing a bunch of stuff to see what's going to be popular. But it's a gamble because in doing that, you end up delaying exponentially getting stuff on the shelves. So, you know, I'm glad that we do what we do, I guess, is my point.
Yeah, nobody's selling nobody's selling any bootleg Justice and Drew merch on Etsy.
And if they are,
I am now.
If they are, I might buy it.
Jason Flores is in studio, everybody.
Excellent job, Sam. Stellar top five. Thanks, Shirley Bird Electric. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, guys.
How you doing?
Living the dream.
You guys got some stuff going on with Americans for Prosperity.
A lot of stuff going on right now.
Why don't we get the plugs out of the way early so we don't have to cram them in right at the end?
Well, I think we'll probably cram them in at the end too, won't we? Well, with the legislative session coming up, we've got our annual session preview event Tuesday, January 28th, 5:30 to 8:00. It's at the Capitol Ridge Hotel in St. Paul. It's formerly the Kelly Inn right across kitty corner from the Capitol there. Really a chance for folks from around the state to come out. We're going to unveil our legislative agenda, talk about our priorities for the year. We've got representatives from both the House and the Senate joining us to talk about their plans for a bunch of different issues and how they think the session's going to go. Senator Gazelka's confirmed to join us. And then We're going to take questions from the crowd, too, right? Because one of the biggest things that we try to do at Americans for Prosperity is connect you with those elected officials, give you a chance to make your voice heard and, mm-hmm. and put you in the right spot at the right time to have an impact on the process. And let me tell you, this legislative session is going to be ripe for opportunities for impact because there are so many bad ideas out there already that we need to work on and build that grassroots movement against in many ways. We'd love you to come out and join us. MNSessionPreview.com is where you can sign up and register. The dinner, the event, all of that, it's all free to register, free to join us. We do need you to commit to it so I can make sure I've got enough space and enough food.
This is not a budget year. So we're talking, you know, it's
I think every year is a budget year in Minnesota. There's deadline shutdown budget year, but they're going to be fighting about money.
Sure, of course they are. But the big fight's going to be the bonding bill, right? The big massive giant Governor Walz wants, I don't know, $800 billion some
$1 trillion
number on his, you know, that he's already throwing out right there. So that's going to occupy a lot of the attention and a lot of the oxygen out of the session. What are your priorities when you're talking about Americans for Prosperity, your legislative priorities? What are you going to be hammering the legislators to focus on?
Yeah, that bonding bill fits into it because we're going to be trying to sound the drum about fiscal responsibility in St. Paul. We've grown. I don't. No. No laughing. It's not a laughing matter. Come on, man. But after years, years of double-digit increases, now we're going to go out when we have a surplus, when you've already overcharged taxpayers by $1.2 billion, by $1.5 billion, whatever you want to call it, when you have historic levels of reserves, which I'll say is a good thing to have some of those reserves, now you're going to go out and put $2 billion on the credit card? Why? And then you take a look at what those bonding projects are, and there's going to be some statewide stuff in there. There's going to be some transportation stuff. There's going to be upkeep of state assets. I get all that part. But you dig down into it, and to get the majorities that you're going to need, especially in the House, you're going to have a whole bunch of local pork that's going into these. You're going to have this community center in nowhere. You're going to have this little special project. Hopefully we get another $8 million rest stop on the way to Duluth, because that'd be a great use of taxpayer dollars. But that's what happens, is you borrow money for stuff that you don't need when you're already taxing too much. So we're going to be talking a lot about fiscal stuff. We're going to talk about the gas tax, how that fits into this. We're going to talk about how last year they made a mistake in continuing the provider tax, adding healthcare costs on top of people who already can't afford it. And we're going to dig into some criminal justice reform issues as well.
Well, and you know, and serving as an example, it's almost like we need, and I'm not calling for this, right, but it's almost like we need like this sort of a legislative version of what we're dealing with right now with this impeachment trial, of these lengthy hearings and time spent at the state capitol. And I say that because, by example, the other day when we brought up there was an article about the bonding bill.
Yep.
And we ended up wiping out like a quarter of the show on one particular item, and that was the desire to give money to the Minnesota Zoo to refurbish the failed monorail into a walking path, right?
Right.
So we went down this rabbit hole on that one thing alone, went back over its history, broke it down, the disaster that it was back then and how it never should have been created, the ridiculousness of paying money now to go and make it into something else. I say all that because how many different items do we have in this bonding bill? How many different ways? I mean, right, there's not enough shows in a year right to do what we did on that one issue based off of all the garbage that they want to pay for in this bonding.
Well, and the governor's going to come out and say, well, I only selected $2 billion worth of projects out of the 6 or 7 or 8, whatever the final number of what local governments and other units and non-government yet dependent on government units like the Minnesota Zoo come up with. Okay. You put out a request, hey, we want to give you free money. What can we do for you? You're going to get a ton of results.
Of course.
You're going to get a ton of asks. That doesn't mean that, oh, well, we only accepted a quarter of them, and that's fiscally responsible. No. The problem is that we're already paying. The state of Minnesota, we go through this fight every 2 years, the budget showdown, the constitutional deadline, and everything that we talked about. Every 2 years, we go through that, and then the next year, we just blow through those numbers, borrow a couple $1 billion more. We can't afford the payments anymore. Yes, the state of Minnesota, compared with some other states like New Jersey or California, fairly fiscally sound, right? We've done some things right. There's no question. But that doesn't mean that, oh, you can get a low interest rate. Let's borrow a ton of money that you don't need.
We're
you
not
qualify
going to be fiscally sound in 10 years, right. in 15 years, in 20 years, if every 2 years we have a record-setting bonding bill, and that's what's been happening. That's been the pattern.
It's this analogy with, think of the housing crisis a couple of years ago. You could qualify for a massive house based on income, based on assets, based on potential, life, all that. So you could qualify for a house way too big for what you could afford in a month. Mm-hmm. That's what the state is doing. They're trying to buy a house that is massively too large, that overextends their resources, and that they're going to have a hard time making the payments on. We're paying $1 billion a year just in debt service on a out of a $50 billion budget. Think of having $1 billion a year more on the bottom line that you could spend on schools if they deserve that, made policy changes for it, that you could invest in real, actual critical infrastructure like roads and bridges. But
or
you don't have it.
You could cut taxes.
Which is what they should be doing with the surplus.
$1 billion right. more that they could have in the year if they weren't spending it all on debt service. We wouldn't have to be one of the most highest tax states in the nation. We could attract more businesses. We could attract more individuals. We can attract more entrepreneurs. More businesses could start up in the state of Minnesota. This is one of the worst states to start a business in because of the tax environment, because of the regulatory environment.
And the uncertainty that goes along with that regulatory environment, where you can do everything right in this state, as some companies have recently found out, you can jump through every hurdle for over a decade, and then still arbitrarily at the end of the road, you got to go back to the 20-yard line.
Now, this is tell me if this is true or not, because I want to hear you speak a little bit on expectations. Obviously, last year, we were able to do away with, or at least keep the Walz' gas tax from coming to fruition,
right?
But when we're talking about, like, for example, this bonding bill, or the article I have here in front of me, you know, how to pay for roads and bridges, funding battle to continue in state capital, we can talk about this. But talk a little bit about expectations, because it's pretty clear, and you know this, you know, I don't need to repeat it, but I will. When you're pushing back against, you know, plans like this within the legislature, you got to push back hard to make even the slightest bit of ground, right?
So, absolutely.
So talk a little bit about sort of expectations of what you tangibly see is possible in trying to rein in this reckless spending attached to something like a bonding bill.
Well, for the bonding bill, they need bigger votes. You need the bigger majorities, especially in the House, to pass it. And that's going to mean that you have to have some conservative, some Republican votes. So that's an opportunity to trim that down. Part of what the governor's doing, same thing he did at the beginning of the year last year, where he proposed this and this and that and this and this and this and that and that and this. And then he compromised with only raising health care taxes by over $1 billion, right? So I don't think there's any way or any part of his mind where he's like, I'm going to get a $2 billion bonding bill, when his own budget forecast and the budget that was put in place last year, it calls for about a $750 million bonding bill. Because guess what? You have to factor these interest payments into the budget. Mm-hmm. So you actually have to change the budget, use some of the surplus to allocate more money to interest payments if you want to do that big of a bonding bill. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not going to happen. So this is a little bit of that negotiate from the extremes that we see too often at the legislature, where I want $2 billion, I want zero, I want $2 billion. You're going to end up
right
kind of around where it's traditionally been. And again, we have some resources that make sense to pay for in the long term, right? And that you take care of some of that big picture infrastructure, some of the higher ed things, roads and bridges should be a big part of this. It has a role.
I've never been totally anti-bonding. I'm not saying we should never do bonding bills. It's got a role. It's got a place. But it gets routinely abused year after year after year.
It is always abused. And there are always these cute little local projects that get in that should be funded some way else.
Right.
Or you take a whole bunch of money that didn't make it into the budget process last year, that couldn't get the votes just 6 months or 8 months ago now, that couldn't get the votes for the money, and now we're going to bond for it instead of just doing the appropriation that it would have been.
Yeah, you end up with like all these Tom Bach wildlife preservation centers.
Right, right. Never mind that on top of all this, you've got a $1.2 billion that you should be returning to taxpayers. And here's the idea that I've wanted to put out there, is we've done, I think, a smart thing every time that we have a surplus by law, by statute, by law, not in the Constitution. We've taken some of that money, put it into the savings account, the first third, has to automatically go into the rainy day fund right off the top. And then you have the surplus number. Well, okay, so let's take the other third. Let's make that one third of it has to go back to taxpayers. I'm willing to make that compromise if we can't do it all. Let's start with something. So automatically one third of any surplus goes to savings. That's what a family or business would do. One third of it goes back, right, to taxpayers to keep that money in the private sector where it's actually functioning to make more money and to make Minnesota more prosperous. And then we can talk about how we spend that other third. I think that's a bit of a compromise.
Coming up, we'll get to a few more items. We do want to dive a bit into this how to pay for roads and bridges based off the Star Tribune article. Also, there's an article out of also from the Star Tribune today about St. Paul wanting to impose a 1% sales tax for streets, housing, and pre-K. We want to get your thoughts on. Before we go to break, though, we talked about sort of expectations. What is your optimism level given the current makeup of the legislature? You know, looking at sort of where those votes are going to be coming from, you know, who might go a certain way. Have you had a chance to sort of look at it? And are you optimistic about opportunities this session to stop the nonsense? Or
I am, or because not? As much as the governor wants to think he can pass a gas tax this year because he didn't get a bite at it last year, he is not going to succeed in raising gas taxes in an election year. Period. It's too, that tax, the reason last year, and I think we talked about it on the show, the reason they went with the provider taxes, the compromise, and continued that tax was because nobody really understands how they're paying for that. If you would have taken that same dollar amount of money and gotten it out of the gas tax, everybody would have gone to the pump the next day after enactment and said, what's going on?
Yeah.
Why are you raising? And then they would have looked at the potholes, and then they would have looked at the snow on the roads, and they would have said, no way am I paying. So it's not going to happen in an election. It's going to take effort, and it's going to take groups like ours and all the phone calls, all the doors that we knocked on last year to make sure that that didn't happen. We're going to do it again. And we're going to do that on the gas tax, and we're going to talk about the healthcare and provider tax. So it's going to take effort, but I'm optimistic that we will defeat that terrible gas tax idea again.
I will say it's really nice right now with the weather being what it is and my streets not properly paved because they're bumpy across the board and all the potholes are filled.
There
so
you
it's,
go.
It's really
filled with ice.
They're filled with ice, yeah.
Talking with Jason Flores from Americans for Prosperity. You going to stick around for an extra segment?
I sure will.
We're going to rapid fire a few local stories at you, get your take on them as well, plus talk about some of your other priorities beyond just the bonding bill. Stick around. Welcome back to your Wednesday edition of Justice and Drew. 651-989-5855 is the phone number, #250 on any mobile device, and saying TCNT will also get you in here. If you've got any questions or comments for our in-studio guest, Jason Flores from Americans for Prosperity, joining us for one more segment.
Before we go back and talk about money, let's talk a little bit about weapons. From the Star Tribune, several leading Republican lawmakers in Minnesota are asking officials in Sherburne County to provide leadership on gun owner rights by designating their central Minnesota county the state's first Second Amendment sanctuary. Yesterday, if you missed it, at 7:35, you can hear it on the show podcast on the iHeartRadio app. We did have Representative Shane Mecklen on. He wrote a letter to the Sherburne County Board of Commissioners. He, along with five of the lawmakers, cited the anti-Second Amendment legislation making the headlines around the country. All six districts represent Sherburne County, runs from Elk River to St. Cloud, northwest of the Twin Cities. And of course, Mecklen's letter came as Republicans who control the Minnesota Senate rolled out a package of pro-gun measures at a public hearing yesterday in Hibbing. So I guess the question is, how much of the conversation do you think is going to be dominated by Second Amendment issues? And, you know, while it's is that a fight in this session worth having? I'm wondering just what kind of impact this could potentially have on the other issues that we're dealing with and that we've been talking about.
But we've already seen it have an impact on the discussions at the Capitol just because it sucks so much air out of the room and so much time is spent. And I think the Senate spent a lot of time last year not taking care of it. Now, this is the second year of the biennium, the traditional policy year. So this is when you consider this stuff. And you see that they've taken proactive action on that already.
Sure.
Going up to Hibbing and having the first of what I assume would be quite a few hearings on it. The where it gets tied up and where it impacts other priorities is that the Minnesota House and Senate, for better or worse, I would argue worse, has so much fun putting together these massive omnibus bills at the end of a session. A little less prevalent during the non-budget year than others. But when you have a big gorilla of an issue like that,
right,
that can potentially be put into or be wrapped into any of a couple different omnibus bills, then if you have other policy things that you're working on, then they get stuck into this bill that has this big poison pill on the top, and all of a sudden all the work you do on that issue has nothing to do with the vote that somebody takes, right? So I would just continue to ask legislators and plead with them to take some of these issues and deal with them as single subject reform.
Yeah.
We should deal, and we should have the conversation on gun control. Let's do it as a single issue, but leave these other things out of it and vote on these smaller, maybe B-level issues on their own merits in their own bills.
And you immediately answered part two of my question, and that was going to be, how much does the Second Amendment conversation end up affecting the bonding conversation and those two things? And then, and I completely agree, and you're sort of ugh over there. I echo that, because you're right. These should be handled separately. These issues should not be lumped together, because you're going to have those in the legislature that are going to be making deals on two completely separate major issues. Yep. And that's not how this should be done.
Yep. Omnibus bills are where good ideas go to die.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's so frustrating, especially when we have a rule in Minnesota that every bill's supposed to be single subject.
Single subject. I think that
they're not supposed to exist at all.
It takes good policy ideas that maybe get caught up in a bill like this where it's a single subject vote, never mind that there's hundreds of other provisions in there.
The subject is Minnesota. That's the single world. Subject.
Subject so is prosperity.
Everything fits into Minnesota. It's fine.
It's also a problem from an accountability perspective, where it's one thing for folks to promise things on the campaign trail, one thing to say things on Twitter, whatever else. I tend to judge legislators by what they actually do and by what they actually vote on and what they've accomplished in their tenure as a legislator.
That's fair.
When you have these big omnibus bills, then it disguises and it hides so many of those votes where you can't get a clear up or down version on where somebody's at on even on something as clear as this tax or that tax or this regulation or that. These big problems that we have with taxes and regulation, they're all hidden behind, well, we have to pass this, you know, constitutional budget deadline, $1 billion bill, and well, how do you feel about this issue? Then I have to trust what they say on Twitter. That doesn't work.
Exactly. It gives legislators cover,
right,
to support bad ideas, and to support terrible ideas, to even support things that they have overtly campaigned against.
Yep.
And then you go to them and you say, well, why did you vote? Well, I had to.
Yep.
I had to. There were so many important things in that omnibus bill.
I heard Greta there.
And to your point, John,
we need a Greta Thunberg then.
We do.
How dare you support that omnibus bill?
To your point about how long and drawn out some of these processes are, that's also why you have these massively long floor debates on bills where the outcome is predetermined. You know what the final vote is going to be on that bill, but you have so much process because the only way that I can get an up or down vote on something is by having an amendment to take it out. Even though that amendment's going to lose or win or fail or whatever else, that's the process we've resorted to as opposed to just voting on a single subject bill. Okay, cast a vote, next. What single subject are we on now? Okay, vote next.
Somebody just tuning in could have easily mistook what you just said for the impeachment trial. Like when you were saying that, like, oh my gosh, that you could say that exact same thing.
I might be saying that there's a bigger problem in this culture with politics than just is either in this state or in the impeachment trial. There may be some bigger picture societal and accountability problems at play.
All right, let's go here while we have some time. Leery of new property tax hikes. St. Paul leaders want to impose a local sales tax to pay for repairs.
That's still a tax hike.
To crumbling streets, development of more affordable housing, and launch pre-kindergarten programs citywide.
They have so much money already. If they would just prioritize basic services, basic public goods, basic city services, they wouldn't need another penny.
Look, I'm a St. Paul resident, and I'm kind of in tune with this, you know, and I understand how these budgets and the fiscal stuff and the interplay of the state. I get how all this works.
How many kids do you have?
We have three at home.
Okay, you're gonna be start pumping out some more so you can get those sweet $50 checks.
I mean, give me my savings bond, you know, right away, and I can just move to St. Paul. You get $50 when you compare that kind of idea with what the city spends their money on or doesn't spend their money on, and now we're going to raise taxes again? I mean, you want to get people in St. Paul fired up from, I would have to argue, all sides of the aisle. This is the way to do it. Because everybody knows
this is pitchforks and torches type material, right?
That's right. Everybody knows they're not spending their money well already, and they just got done with years of double digit property tax increases. So now they're like, "Well, we're gonna leave that alone for a little while. So let's go tax this over here instead, rather than possibly spending money more responsibly."
Jason, floor is America's for prosperity. Before we let you go, what you got going on again?
Well, we have our session preview dinner coming up. It's actually just over or just under a week from now, next Tuesday, the 28th, 5:30 to 8 p.m. at the Capitol Ridge Hotel in St. Paul. That's that former Kelly Inn, just kitty corner from the state office building there. We're going to unveil our priorities. We're going to have a free dinner, great dinner, just approved the menu the other day. Got legislative leadership coming in
free
to
food,
talk.
Y'all.
There's no such thing as a free lunch, but there is a free dinner at our session preview event. Anyway, great conversation about the issues. Chance to network not only with lawmakers, but with activists from around the state. Just go to mnsessionpreview.com. You can register there. The entire event is free to attend. Do need you to RSVP in advance, though. Got to make sure we plan and have seats for everybody.
What's on the menu?
It's going to be a variety of roasted meats, heavy appetizers, and
it's like one of those the Brazilian.
Right. It is not a Brazilian steakhouse, nor is it a bunch of charcuterie. Yeah. But if you're a Minnesotan, let's eat dinner. You're going to have a good time.
All right,
you're already tall, and those pinkies were really up high. Wow.
Jason Flores, Americans for Prosperity. Thanks, we will tweet out a link to that event here using the hashtag TCNT. Thanks for coming in, man.
Appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, a man who needs no introduction on the show, Deputy Assistant to the President, Principal Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley. Going to talk about that impeachment trial day one yesterday. Also, a garbage lizard person, because they're not human, Adam Schiff. New documents show garbage lizard Schiff mischaracterized evidence in impeachment, in a big way. Like he lied, like hard.
103.5 FM.
AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Justice and Drew, along with Sam, 651-989-5855 is the phone number. And, of course, use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter at any point throughout the show if you don't get through on the phone lines. Want to welcome to the show, very pleased to welcome back, the Deputy Assistant to the President and Principal Deputy Secretary, Hogan Gidley. Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing really well. Thanks so much for the time. How's everybody up there?
Doing all right. Navigating this ridiculousness of this impeachment trial.
Yeah, we're doing better than you are because we didn't have to watch all 12 hours of that nonsense yesterday. How did you handle that?
Fidget spinners, copious amounts of alcohol. I mean,
I was looking on Twitter for traffic and other things like that. We were kind of joking here in the office some Netflix earnings report was getting more traffic on Twitter than this impeachment deal. I guarantee you, in the Twin Cities, there was probably more focus on Minnesota's chances next year as opposed to, the Vikings' chances next year. I mean, that's what people care about. But let's be honest. I mean, the American people deserve a Congress that works for them, works with this president to get things done that they elected them to do. And, the juxtaposition last week of the president of the United States signing a historic trade deal with China, something that no one thought possible, on the heels of USMCA, on a Japan trade deal, all of those things, what he's doing for the farmers and ranchers and manufacturers across this country versus the ridiculous, illegitimate sham impeachment proceedings, watching the House just trot over papers as they were so proud and they tried to fake this solemnness, this sadness of what they were doing, but they've been caught off camera, yucking it up, laughing about it, fist bumping. And, I got to say, national champions, the LSU Tigers were over here last week. They didn't fist bump or fist pump as much as Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats have in the last few days. The LSU Tigers actually did something. Democrats have done nothing for the American people, and I think this process has really exposed that.
Talking with Hogan Gidley, deputy assistant to the president and principal deputy press secretary. I was getting really frustrated yesterday when I would tune in for bits and pieces. I couldn't stand to watch any really long stretches. It was very frustrating. And what I was really frustrated about is how this is all such a sham. This is all such theater. Everybody knows the outcome of this. Democrats, Republicans, pundits, you know, people in the media, people watching at home. We all know how this ends. So to drag it out like this and to put it on, there was no real legitimate newsworthy reason for all of the networks to break in and carry Adam Schiff's long rambling lie yesterday. There was nothing newsworthy about it whatsoever. So I just came to the conclusion that this is just a campaign commercial. I mean, this is them kicking off their presidential campaign season.
But it's a campaign for us. I mean,
yeah.
look at how this has backfired. I mean, 6 of the 7 managers that Nancy Pelosi thought it wise to put in place were for impeachment before a shred of evidence came out, before the proceedings had even started. So talk about a baked cake. This has been done on the Democrat side. Nancy Pelosi even admitted she'd been working on 2.5 years to get this done, then said she wouldn't move forward unless it was bipartisan. It's bipartisan, all right, against it. Republicans actually picked up votes against this ridiculous thing. So she knew what she was doing. She was placating to that radical base of hers and Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and the rest. Are controlling the party now, and she knows that, and so she's got to do what they want her to do, and she has, and she's taken right over the cliff in the process because the American people don't want this. They know it's an absolute, complete, and utter joke, and you see that because the interesting part, Pat Cipollone made a point, the White House counsel for the president, when he got up first and said, so let me get this straight. This had to be done immediately because it was a clear and present danger, and then, you know, after 6 vacations and they finally passed it, she kept it in her pocket for 33 days and didn't do anything with it. Now we get to the Senate. We want to move forward quickly. And they say, no, we need more time. So they have an ironclad case. They have all this overwhelming evidence. And their first move in the Senate is to say, hey, guys, let's open this up for more witnesses. Let's open this up for more testimony. It sounds like a group that doesn't have their act together and dang sure don't have a case to make to the American people, much less to their colleagues across the Congress over in the Senate. So the fact is, I think we're in pretty good shape here. The facts are on our side. The president did nothing wrong. The process was a joke and a sham, and everyone knows that. Anyone in this country, you get a traffic ticket, you're getting more due process than this president just got. 17 witnesses Democrats called in the House, and we didn't get a single one. We couldn't cross-examine. We couldn't call evidence. None of those things. And here we go. Well, let's move it over to the Senate and see what happens.
Well, and Hogan Gidley, this is more of a statement based off perception than it is sort of a cogent question. But the problem that I saw yesterday, and I'll tell you how I got there. There was commentary in between, especially during some of the roll call amendment votes yesterday. There was quite a bit of commentary, and this is also coming from Republicans, talking about how they didn't understand why it appeared as if the Trump administration and the Senate Republicans were allowing the Democrats to sort of craft the narrative of the day, and that it was actually benefiting the Democrats more. Okay, and this was said by a couple of different people at different hours of the day, which I thought was really interesting. Well, I suddenly began to realize that in the absence of any real substance going on within the impeachment trial, these networks are searching for talking points and things to discuss. Regardless of whether or not the Trump administration and the Senate Republicans did or didn't allow the Democrats to sort of control most of the conversation yesterday, at the end of the day, everybody knows how this vote is going to shake out, so it's completely irrelevant. So it feels like the mainstream media is searching for talking points and they're pulling at certain strings, but ultimately it's irrelevant. Because when this vote goes down, we all know how this vote is going to go down. It's a complete waste of time.
Well, as a Republican lifelong, I really wish we had a complicit and compliant media the way the Democrats do. Boy, we could really get a lot of things done if they just parroted our talking points at every turn. I will say, irrelevant, I'm going to disagree with you slightly. It's irrelevant to the American people in the sense that you're wasting a lot of their time and taxpayer dollars.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
And I know that's, I know you weren't saying, you know, you weren't being flip. I'm just pointing out.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant in the larger scheme of things because we do know that they have no case.
Yeah.
They had a chance to try this in the House. They did. They failed. Every single person they brought up as a witness did not even know or talk to the president directly, except two. And the only two that did said unequivocally there was no quid pro quo and the president didn't break the law. And you see that with the articles of impeachment that have been sent over to the Senate. The articles don't claim a violation of law. They're just made up out of whole obstruction of Congress? What does that even mean? So, look, if the president decides to leave the White House at lunch to head over to one of the monuments or to head out of town to go do, you know, the work of the American people, we have to shut down the roads for a motorcade, things like that. I guess if you prevent them from going to one of their martini lunches, you're obstructing them. So theoretically, just throw that on the pile too. It's not a violation of law. They know it. And the more the American people see this, look at the case we put out. It's pretty simple. The president did nothing wrong. The process was a joke. It's unconstitutional. That's the case. Okay. Here's the evidence. That's the case. There's a reason that Democrats are talking and talking and talking and talking and using every ounce of time, squeezing every ounce of blood from that turnip, because they know two things. That the media will parrot it as truth. But second is, they ain't got nothing.
Right.
They don't have a case.
Right.
So it's simple. If you know, if you're in trial and they say, hey, did you guys murder somebody? You say, no. Here's my receipt. I wasn't even in town at the time of the murder. I was four states over in Iowa, touring Field of Dreams. And they're going to go, oh, okay, that's a pretty simple case. And then your accusers are like, no, there's a lot of things going on at play here. Look at this phone call he made, and I'm not sure. And no. Were you there? Were you not there? You weren't? Okay, then I guess this, you know, they don't have a case. The same thing applies here. We have a pretty rock solid, ironclad case. We presented it. It doesn't take long. When you did nothing wrong, and I didn't mean to do like a,
no.
Oh, I like that
rhyming. I'm just saying it
doesn't have to be long when you did nothing wrong.
I'm gonna put that in the tweet, and I'll give you credit.
Tell my wife that.
There you go.
So can you explain a little bit about what I find what they're doing to be very nefarious? Right, this whole setting the tone and setting the narrative right away that this trial is illegitimate and this outcome is going to be illegitimate because the Senate Republicans are not letting them immediately subpoena John Bolton and Mulvaney or whomever else they immediately, like, if we don't subpoena them immediately, this whole trial is a sham and we can't trust the outcome. Basically, they're setting the table. They know they have no case. They know what the outcome is going to be. So they're going on national TV, and it was certainly nice of NBC and ABC and CBS to cut into their normal programming to carry Adam Schiff all day long so that they could get this narrative out there uninterrupted. They're setting the narrative that the verdict, quote unquote, of this impeachment trial is illegitimate because Democrats aren't being because the Senate is not allowing them to subpoena John Bolton immediately. Can you sort of break that down for people who may not understand why this is such a sham?
A couple of things there. First of all, you hit on Adam Schiff. Let's talk about that for a minute. The Democrats appointed Adam Schiff. The cable networks broke into their programming. You know, billions of dollars of ads lost for Adam Schiff. This is a man who's been caught lying multiple times about Russia collusion evidence that he had stone cold that then we found out didn't exist. He made up a totally phony phone conversation about Ukraine that never happened, lied directly to the American people, lied directly to his colleagues in Congress. Then he lied that his staff didn't have contact with a whistleblower. Okay? If there's anyone that needs to be disqualified from this process, it's Adam Schiff. Okay? That's the first thing. As far as Bolton is concerned, the House had a chance to call all of these witnesses, and they didn't. And they didn't for multiple reasons. One was because it was too urgent. They didn't have time to see whether executive privilege applied, immunity applied to John Bolton. They had to move immediately because this was a clear and present danger. This was a threat to our very national security, as Nancy Pelosi said, And then when she got the articles passed, she held them for 33 days. So we know that's not about principle. That's about politics. Not to mention the fact, over the course of this impeachment, I think the House took 6 vacations. So let's get that out in the open right now. but also, to try and get Bolton at this stage in the game, when they were called, when Kupperman was called his deputy and Bolton were called, Kupperman went to the courts and said, listen, do I have to testify? I need to know this. I need a ruling here because I do have privileged information. I talked to the president directly. You can't just get that information from me because that's sensitive. It's classified. I can't just put that information out. And as soon as he went to the courts, the House withdrew their subpoena of Kupperman and the talk of Bolton as well because they didn't want to wait. So, and by the way, just the mere fact of an American citizen like Kupperman saying, let me just get a ruling from a judge before I go trotting up to the House that and possibly reveal sensitive information. Let me just get a ruling to make sure it's okay I do that. They said, oh, you're in contempt, so we're gonna hold you in contempt of Congress for that. All he was trying to do was find out from a judge if he could legally have a conversation with members of Congress. And let's not pretend as though the members of Congress have some sterling reputation or record, right, for that matter, of keeping classified information classified.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So, look, a lot of things are going on here, but the bottom line is the Democrats are completely running an illegitimate sham process. It's being exposed at every turn. You see it with every word they speak. All of the half truths, the lies, misquoting the transcript again. He did that. Adam Schiff did. It's pretty comical. And quite frankly, we'd all be having a good laugh if it wasn't the American people who are the butt of the joke.
Before we let you go, I tried to do the math on how long this could potentially take based off these rules, and then I stopped. So I'm Hogan Kidley. Before we let you go this morning, what is your expectation on how long this? How long is it going to be until we actually go to a vote and we end all this?
First of all, I was told there would be no math. Number one. But number two, look, we're ready for whatever the Senate decides to do. It's up to them as the body who's in control of this. The president has said before, look, if you'd been lied about for 3.5 years with no proof and no evidence, anyone within the sound of our voices would say, I want everyone to come forward and say, I did nothing wrong. We all know it. Defend me vehemently so that the people can see I am vindicated, exonerated in totality. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's the way it's going to work out. And since we've seen the process be such a sham, where they did everything behind the scenes in the House, they wouldn't let us call witnesses. They wouldn't let us present evidence. They wouldn't let us cross-examine witnesses. No due process or fairness at all afforded this president. Then why do we really need to keep going for weeks of a trial, for months of a trial? On its face, as our attorneys have argued in the right, any court in the world would throw this out because there is no crime alleged. And then when you get to the actual date before the judge, which is the Senate in this particular instance, the House says, well, now we need more information. We need to open this up for more witnesses. That'd get kicked out. We would be justified in pushing for and getting a dismissal today. But whether it's a short trial, a long trial, an outright dismissal, or something in between, we're going to be ready either way because the facts are on our side, and it's a pretty simple story to tell that the president did nothing wrong. Read the transcript, and we're going to get about the people's business.
Hogan Kidley, fantastic interview. Thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed it, and we look forward to having you on again real soon, okay?
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Go Vikings.
Coming up, we'll switch gears a little bit. We will be getting back to...
I know.
Where?
He was
calling back to another joke.
I appreciate it.
I know. Clearly, Hogan Kidley doesn't understand that we have to handle the jokes.
I'm sad.
Maybe we can send him a message, let him know next time.
I just missed the Vikings.
Coming up on the show, we will switch gears briefly. We are going to talk with Kayleigh McEnany from National Press Secretary for Trump and Jesse Kelly just after 8:35. First off, though, we do have a bit of a Gone Green update.
Oh, good.
That includes Falling Green.
My favorite story of the day.
I love this story.
My favorite story.
The Falling Green Iguanas in Florida.